Welcome to the deep dive. Today, you're plunging. We're plunging headfirst into a topic that, on the surface, might sound like some dusty legal history, but we assure you it strikes directly at the heart of modern American liberty.
It really does.
We are tackling the alleged collapse, and as our source material terms it, the kidnapping of the American Pettit jury.
That's right. And the dossier we've compiled here, it's truly extraordinary. It doesn't just argue the jury system is flawed, which, I mean, I think most people would accept, but that it is fundamentally, legally, and just irrevocably void.
Void, that's a strong word.
It's a huge claim. The argument is that the modern jury, you know, the one that's been reduced in size, systematically muzzled, and almost entirely bypassed, it's nothing more than an administrative fiction.
Okay, so our mission today is to really unpack the staggering legal, historical, and constitutional arguments that are laid out in this material. The central thesis seems to be that the true common law jury has been unlawfully suppressed.
Exactly. We need to get our heads around this concept of the immutable hierarchy of law. Because according to this hierarchy, the Pettit jury must be 12 persons, it must be unanimous, and this is the big one, it must be empowered to judge both the law and the facts of the case.
And if those conditions aren't met, what's the consequence?
Well, and this is the immediate takeaway from the premise. If those three things are not in place, the sources argue that any conviction obtained is not just, you know, a reversible error. It's void ab initio.
Void ab initio, meaning from the beginning.
From the very beginning. Legally speaking, the judgment had no existence from the moment it was issued. It's an act performed entirely without lawful authority. Like, it just never happened.
That is a tectonic legal claim. And we're framing this against what's actually happened to the jury trial. I mean, the institution that was supposed to be the central safeguard of liberty, it's statistically extinct.
The numbers are shocking. We're looking at figures hovering around 98% of criminal cases, both federal and state, that are resolved without any jury at all. They're just replaced by administrative coercion and plea bargains. The founders envisioned the jury as this final barrier between the citizen and the power of the state.
Right.
When you look at that 98% figure, you have to conclude that the barrier has been breached, dismantled, and basically buried.
It's genuinely shocking to realize that the primary mechanism designed to protect you from the state is now used in less than 2% of cases.
Okay, let's unpack this. How did the central safeguard of individual liberty become statistically extinct? And using this hierarchy of law, is this extinction even legal?
To answer that, you have to start at the absolute peak of the legal structure. The sources call this the firewall, a strict, immutable hierarchy of law.
Okay, a firewall.
The argument is that certain laws are so fundamental that no human institution, not the Supreme Court, not Congress, not even, you know, the collective will of the people, has the power to alter them.
So we're starting with sources that exist above, above even the Constitution itself. What is at this absolute peak? Level one is the law of nature. This is the source above all others. It defines the conditions of universal justice. And for this, we have to turn to Blackstone, whose commentaries were, they were foundational for the American legal system.
Right. Everyone read Blackstone back then.
Everyone. And Blackstone defined the law of nature as, quote, coeval with mankind, dictated by God himself, superior in obligation to any other.
Coeval with mankind. So it's existed as long as we have.
Exactly. So the right to be judged by your peers, a jury that can judge both the law and the facts, that's not some governmental concession. It's not a gift from the state. It's an inherent moral right tied to human dignity and freedom.
It's grounded in natural justice.
Precisely. You know, think of it this way. If a government makes a law that says everyone has to wear a blue hat on Tuesdays, that law is mutable. The legislature can change it. But the right to life, the right to property, the right to be judged by your community instead of just by agents of the state, these are inherent, they're universal, and so they're unamendable. The right to a jury trial, with all its common law features, is a condition of freedom, not a legislative grant.
Which would make that right totally uniform, right? It wouldn't matter which state you live in.
It has to be.
So now we step down one level, but we're still above any statute or constitution. We're at the maxims of law, as cataloged by Sir Edward Coke. Why are these maxims so powerful?
Well, Coke described maxims as the axioms of justice. They are, and this is his phrase, propositions to be of all men confessed and granted without proof, argument, or discourse.
So they're self-evident.
They're self-evident truths. They describe the fundamental proven structure of justice. It's the legal equivalent of saying 1 + 1 = 2. You don't vote on that truth. You just recognize it.
And what are the crucial maxims that define the the unchangeable structure of this common law jury.
The source material really hones in on three. Maxim 67G states, very plainly, that a jury must consist of 12 persons.
Must.
Must. And this isn't some random number. It has deep historical roots in Anglo-Saxon law, often tied to, you know, 12 tribes, 12 apostles, mm-hmm. the whole concept of a complete and representative community. Then Maxim 67 Jerry reinforces this. No one may be convicted except by the verdict of 12.
And that third maxim, this is the one that really challenges the power of the modern judge.
This is the one, Maxim 67b. It asserts that the jury judges both the law and the fact. This is the power the modern system is most afraid of. And the crucial implication of all these maxims is that they cannot be superseded. If a constitution, a statute, a court rule, if any of them contradict a maxim, that inferior law is, by definition, void.
Okay, so if the maxims are the unamendable standard, we need to talk about this idea that legislatures or states have the authority to just change them. This brings us to legal giants like Imre de Vattel.
Right. Vattel, in his Law of Nations, he wrote specifically about the limits of government power. And he said that fundamental laws, like the structure of the jury, which existed before the state did, he said they ought to possess stability. And his exact words were that they are exempt from legislative modification.
So a state legislature can make policy, but it can't redefine the universal components of justice itself.
That's the argument. And then Thomas Cooley, he delivers what the source material calls the nuclear-grade legal truth in his work, Constitutional Limitations. This one quote, it seems designed to just dismantle the entire structure of modern statutory deviation.
What did he say?
He wrote, neither the officers of the state nor the whole people as an aggregate body are at liberty to take action in opposition to these fundamental laws.
Wait, let's break that down for a second. That means even if 99% of the population passed a constitutional amendment tomorrow saying we only want six-person juries, that amendment would still be illegal and void under this hierarchy.
Absolutely. That is the core of the argument. Because the right to a 12-person law-judging unanimous jury is a fundamental law from nature and maxims. It's immune from both legislative action and popular sovereignty. Everything below it, state constitutions, court rules, statutes, has to conform.
This just, it utterly obliterates the notion of states' rights to define their own jury rules.
It does. A right can't be universal and God-given in Texas, but suddenly, you know, a negotiable policy in California. The sources argue that when states try to amend jury rights, reducing the size, getting rid of unanimity, they are not operating lawfully. They're acting ultra vires.
Beyond their lawful authority.
Right. And that is the clear sign of corruption. The deviation isn't a policy choice. It's a break in foundational law, which makes any conviction that results from it void ab initio.
So if we accept that this fundamental law is unchangeable, we have to nail down exactly what the Pettit jury was designed to be historically. This means we have to go back to the definitive texts that the founders were reading.
We have to. And we start with the foundation. Magna Carta, from 1215. The core protection, Clause 39, declared, no free man shall be deprived of life or liberty except by the lawful judgment of his peers.
The judgment of his peers.
This is the common law's definitive statement. The founders, when they adopted the common law, they inherited this entire structure. It's a pre-constitutional right, which means the U.S. system just recognized it and protected it. It didn't create it.
And then jurists like Blackstone and Coke, they came along and basically systematized these definitions.
He did. Blackstone was. He is emphatic. He called the trial by jury the glory of the English law. And he emphasized the number 12 and unanimity as non-negotiable essential definitions. He saw the jury as this natural independent check on government standing outside the direct control of the judiciary.
And Coke, he was even more definitive, wasn't he? Especially on the legal consequences if you deviate.
He was absolute on the number 12. Coke stated that a lawful Pettit jury must consist of 12, and a verdict by fewer is inherently void. But what's really crucial here is his insistence that even the defendant cannot consent to fewer than 12.
Why not?
Because the jury isn't just the defendant's right, it's the public's right. It's the people's right to oversee government proceedings and make sure justice is actually done.
I see.
So the moment that modern courts started allowing waivers or six-person panels, the argument is they were operating outside the historical authority defined by these maxims.
Okay. If the founders were so clear that the jury stood above the judge, the question becomes, when did the government decide it could just ignore all of that history? I mean, the founders' intent seems completely opposite to the modern idea of judicial supremacy.
Oh, it is. The founders were explicit that the jury stood over the judge on matters of law. You just have to look at John Adams. He stated that the juror has a duty to find a verdict, quote, according to his own best understanding, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court.
Wait, that is a powerful statement. Adams is telling the juror to trust their own conscience and their own understanding of justice, even if the man in the black robe tells them something else.
Exactly. I mean, that single statement is devastating to the modern judicial model, where jurors are explicitly told, you must follow my explanation of the law, regardless of whether they think it's fair or constitutional. A jury that just obeys the judge on the law is not the jury Adams was talking about.
And Hamilton backed this up.
Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist 83, he called juries the very palladium of free government.
The palladium again.
They were specifically intended to be the people's tool to prevent arbitrary prosecutions, to resist unjust statutes, and to check corrupt judges. The whole design was for juries to supervise the judiciary, not for the judiciary to supervise the juries.
And this leads us right to the core function that the modern system actively suppresses, the power of nullification.
Absolutely. For centuries, judges didn't instruct jurors on the law. It was just assumed that jurors would interpret statutes, they'd weigh the constitutionality of the law as it was being applied, and they would refuse to convict if they felt the law itself was unjust.
Like in the Zenger trial?
That's the famous colonial example.
Yeah.
The John Peter Zenger trial in 1735. Zenger was charged with seditious libel for criticizing the royal governor. The judge instructed the jury to find Zenger guilty. Because the facts, you know, the fact that he published it were undisputed.
But the jury refused.
They absolutely refused. They found him not guilty. They exercised their right to judge the law itself, deciding that the law, used to suppress political speech, was unjust and invalid. That one act of nullification was instrumental in establishing freedom of the press in America.
And this power wasn't just some rogue jury thing. It was confirmed by the highest court in the land very early on.
Yes. In the earliest U.S. Supreme Court case to address this, George v. Brailsford in 1794, Chief Justice John Jay instructed the jury directly. He told them, look, it's presumed the court is correct on the law, but his words were, it is still true that both objects, law, and fact are lawfully within your power of decision.
The history couldn't be clearer. The Constitution didn't invent the jury. It preserved this powerful law-judging institution.
And that's the fascinating takeaway from the source material. Because the Constitution preserved the common law jury, it means Congress has no authority to change its size, courts cannot restrict its scope, and states can't just unilaterally get rid of unanimity. The Sixth Amendment guarantees a jury trial, but that term has to incorporate the common law structure, 12 people, unanimous verdict, and the power to judge law and fact. Any attempt to modify these features is, according to the argument, an illegal act of substitution.
So the modern system, as we know it, just us, it operates by ignoring this entire hierarchy. Let's trace how the states and the federal rules systematically broke these fundamental requirements, often while using this lofty, almost hypocritical language.
Yeah, the sources point to what they call the inviolate clause paradox. State constitutions, almost all of them, mandate that the right to a jury trial shall remain inviolate or shall be preserved entire.
Right. They say the right things.
They acknowledge its sanctity. But these are the same states that have spent the last century authorizing six-person juries, non-unanimous verdicts, and judicial instructions that specifically forbid law judging.
Okay, let's take the size issue first, the voidness of six-person juries. The Supreme Court actually gave states the green light to do this, didn't they?
They did, in what the sources call a landmark betrayal of common law. A 1970 case, Williams v. Florida, the Supreme Court ruled that a six-person jury in a state non-capital case was constitutional. Their reasoning was that the number 12 was just a historical accident, not a required functional component.
But under the hierarchy we just established, the maxims of law, that ruling should be completely void.
Absolutely. Under Koch's Maxim 67G, a six-person jury isn't a legal variation. It's a direct contradiction of fundamental, unamendable law. It's an ultra-virus act. The sources argue that Williams v. Florida was an illegitimate policy decision that illegally substituted an administrative process for a constitutional right.
So states like Florida, Texas, and California that use six-person panels for misdemeanors, they're operating without lawful authority, regardless of what the Supreme Court said.
That is the argument. And the violation extends to unanimity, too. I mean, that was broken down in criminal cases in some states for a long time.
Right, Louisiana and Oregon.
That's right. For decades, they permitted non-unanimous criminal verdicts, until the Supreme Court finally overruled that in Ramos v. Louisiana in 2020. They acknowledged the practice was rooted in historical racism and violated the common law standard. But the fact that it went on for so long just shows the disregard for fundamental law.
And unanimity isn't just procedural, is it?
No, the argument is that it's a natural law requirement. It ensures the verdict truly reflects the collective conscience of the community, not just a majority opinion. A fractured verdict is considered void ab initio under the maxims.
What about the common practice of a defendant waiving their right to a jury trial altogether?
This is a really deep structural flaw in the system, according to the sources. Like we discussed with Koch, the petit jury isn't just the defendant's private right to be waived. It's the public's right to oversee government power. The jury is the community's sentinel.
So one person can't unilaterally waive the public's oversight function.
Exactly. So any judicial approval of a waiver is legally questionable because the judge, an agent of the state, is approving the removal of the very check placed upon the state. The individual has a right to demand a jury, but not necessarily a right to abolish it for their specific case.
Let's shift to the federal level. Congress has regulated this process pretty extensively.
They have. Congress passed the Jury Selection and Service Act, which the sources claim is unconstitutional from the get-go, because Congress has no enumerated power in Article 1, Section 8 to regulate a natural law institution like the jury. But even more brazen is Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 23B.
What's that one do?
This rule allows a court to continue a trial and accept a verdict with only 11 jurors, even without the defendant's consent, if a juror is dismissed for cause after deliberations have already started.
That's a direct functional rejection of the number 12.
It's a direct contradiction of Koch's maxim 67G. If the common law says that even consenting to fewer than 12 is void, and the system allows for an involuntary substitution to 11, I mean, the rule is just fundamentally mistaken. It reveals the judiciary's view that the number 12 is disposable, that the constitutional safeguard is just bureaucratic policy. The moment they allow that deviation, the verdict loses its common law legitimacy.
So the system didn't just break the rules. It captured the institution itself. It completely inverted the original design where the jury was meant to be superior to the judges and prosecutors.
And that capture starts really early, during voir dire.
The jury selection process.
Right. Historically, this was a very limited process to make sure jurors weren't, you know, related to the parties or had a direct financial interest. Today, it's become an ideological filtration process. Prosecutors and judges actively use it to systematically exclude jurors who exhibit any independence, who express distrust in government, or who show any awareness of the jury's true historical powers.
So they're weeding out anyone who might be a nullification risk. It's not selection, it's ideological cleansing.
It is entirely about manufacturing compliance. You see prosecutors striking jurors for reading books on constitutional history, for having a slightly libertarian view, or for just asking too many smart questions about the fairness of the law itself. They are trying to create a pool of passive rule followers.
Which the founders would have instantly recognized as a corrupt practice.
They would have. It's designed to guarantee convictions, not to ensure justice. They want a rubber stamp, not a palladium of liberty.
And then the capture is solidified with judicial gag orders. The judge looks at the jury and says, point blank, you must follow the law as I explain it, and you may not judge the law itself.
This is the most profound betrayal of the common law jury. A judge commanding a jury to follow the law just violates everything laid out by Adams and Blackstone. The source material argues, very forcefully, that a jury that cannot judge the law is not a jury. It's been reduced to a simple fact-finding committee, completely subservient to the state's interpreter of the law, the judge.
If the jury loses its power to judge the law, it loses its ability to prevent injustice.
Which was its primary historical function. And when this manufactured compliance fails, when a single juror holds out on principle, the state resorts to coercion, often through the Allen charge.
The dynamite charge.
The dynamite charge, yeah. It's this notorious judicial instruction delivered when a jury reports a deadlock. The judge basically tells the minority jurors to seriously question their own judgment against the majorities, strongly encouraging them to reconsider with a disposition to be convinced.
But that holdout juror, by standing on principle, they are the very conscience of the trial that the founders relied on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They are the single final constitutional check. A verdict that's achieved through that kind of judicial pressure and coercion is not a true verdict under natural law. Maxim 67 states that a verdict is the dictative truth. A verdict achieved through fear or pressure or just exhaustion is fundamentally dishonest and therefore void.
And the government's fear of an informed jury is, it's palpable. You can see it in how they react to people who try to educate the public.
Oh, the government is terrified of an informed populace. You have organizations like the Fully Informed Jury Association or FIJ. All they do is try to share pamphlets explaining that jurors have the lawful power to judge the law and acquit based on conscience if a law is unjust.
And what happens to them?
Members of FIJ have been labeled extremists and arrested for jury tampering.
If the state considers telling citizens their constitutional rights to be a criminal act of tampering, that just proves the system is not designed for lawful oversight. It's designed for controlled conviction outcomes.
That's the source material's conclusion. If the legitimacy of the entire system relies on the ignorance of the jurors about their own power, then the system itself is illegitimate. The government knows that if even 10% of the population understood and exercised the right of nullification, its ability to enforce unjust, arbitrary, or petty laws would just immediately collapse.
Okay, this is where we move into the 21st century dismantling of the jury. The modern jury pool is no longer selected by a sheriff talking to neighbors. It's selected by proprietary software, creating a constitutional rupture that we literally cannot see. Here's where it gets really interesting.
This is the destruction of the common law requirement of vicinage.
Vicinage, meaning from the neighborhood.
From the neighborhood, yeah. Common law required jurors to be neighbors of sufficient estate. The idea was to inject local knowledge, community sentiment, shared conscience into the trial. But modern digital systems, they select jurors from these massive centralized databases, DMV lists, voter rolls, tax records, and they filter them using opaque proprietary algorithms.
So the result is an algorithmic fiction. It's a mathematical simulation of a community, not the local, physically present sentinel the jury was supposed to be.
And the greatest constitutional injury here is the opacity problem. The source code for these jury wheel systems is secret. The algorithms that weigh and filter potential jurors are undisclosed. The vendors enforce NDAs and indemnity clauses that prohibit any inspection or public audit of the mechanisms.
But wait a minute. If the process that selects the people who are supposed to hold the government accountable is a secret, how can it possibly be legitimate?
It can't be. That's the argument. A constitutional institution has to rely on transparency and verifiable logic. A jury whose selection mechanism cannot be scrutinized by the people is illegitimate by definition. The selection is outsourced to a black box. This opaqueness is fundamentally incompatible with the required legitimacy of a common law institution. You can't challenge a result if you're legally barred from even inspecting the method that was used to get it.
And these systems are not just opaque, they're demonstrably vulnerable to algorithmic bias or outright manipulation. This would allow the government to basically profile the jury pool.
Well, the systems are designed to sort, filter, and weigh potential jurors based on data profiles. If the government can set the parameters, say, filtering out areas with high concentrations of non-voters or specific political demographics, it is shaping the political and psychological profile of the jury before the voir dire process even begins. This is structural manipulation, designed to minimize unexpected verdicts.
Let's connect this to some real-world examples, because it can sound like a hypothetical conspiracy theory, but it involves the same kind of software vulnerabilities we've seen in other sensitive government functions.
Sure. You can look at the Antrim County, Michigan voting machine incident back in 2020. The reports demonstrated that software used for counting tallies, which is similar in mechanism to selection software, was capable of weighting or applying fractional tallies to votes.
Okay.
So if a system can fractionally weigh a vote, it is technically capable of algorithmically weighting or filtering a potential juror based on proprietary criteria. The integrity of the process is just gone when the weighting algorithm is a secret.
And the security concerns are just as severe.
Absolutely. You can consider the Maricopa County, Arizona case in 2022, where the CEO of Connect, a company managing election worker data, was arrested for allegedly exfiltrating that data to servers in China. These incidents, while they're related to elections, they prove the inherent data insecurity and foreign access vulnerability of proprietary systems managing sensitive public data, and that includes juror data. We are relying on uninspectable, commercially managed systems to safeguard the fundamental liberty of who gets to judge the state.
So the government selects the people who will judge it, and the citizens are legally prevented from inspecting the process used to select them.
It's a total inversion of liberty. The use of computerized jury selection systems, the source argues, fundamentally violates the historical requirement of vicinage, the principle of transparency, and the rule that the people must judge the government, not the other way around. Every trial drawing from such a compromised, opaque pool is illegitimate.
The biggest evidence that the jury has been captured isn't found in legal statutes or technology, though. It's in the overwhelming volume of cases that never even reach trial. The Pettit jury is functionally extinct.
You just have to look at the cold, hard statistics. 98.3% of federal convictions come from guilty pleas. In state felony cases, we consistently see figures between 94 and 98%.
It's unbelievable.
The founders' palladium of liberty, the Sixth Amendment guarantee of a public trial by an impartial jury, is. It's an artifact. It's used in less than 2% of the justice system.
And this administrative system, it thrives on duress, not on autonomy. Let's detail the most powerful mechanism of coercion here, the trial penalty.
The trial penalty is the threat of sentences that are exponentially harsher if a defendant insists on their constitutional right to a trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's legalized extortion. Prosecutors intentionally overcharge cases, stacking mandatory minimums and counts to create leverage that no rational defendant can ignore.
Can you give us a concrete example so we can really feel the weight of that decision?
Sure. Imagine a nonviolent drug case. A prosecutor reviews the evidence and determines that a reasonable plea offer, based on the crime and a lack of prior history, is 3 years in prison. However, the prosecutor stacks charges that carry harsh mandatory minimums if it goes to trial. If the defendant rejects the plea and loses at trial, those stacked counts could result in a 30-year sentence.
So the choice isn't really between pleading guilty and fighting for innocence. The choice is between 3 years and 30 years.
Precisely. That is not choice. That is duress. Your constitutional right to a jury trial is weaponized against you. Because the outcome of a trial is inherently uncertain, especially if you're facing a filtered, compliance-driven jury, the rational choice is to accept the guaranteed, devastating, but survivable 3-year sentence. The system is designed to bypass the constitutional safeguard through fear.
And this collapse is so complete that the judicial branch has openly admitted that the constitutional system has been replaced.
Yes. In the 2012 Supreme Court cases of Loeffler v. Cooper and Missouri v. Fry, the court made an admission that should horrify any constitutional scholar. They stated, quote, "Plea bargaining is not some adjunct to the criminal justice system. It is the criminal justice system."
That quote is a judicial obituary for the Constitutional Republic. The government, through its own highest court, just confessed that the system described in the Bill of Rights, the trial system, has been entirely replaced by a negotiated administrative system.
And this brings us right back to due process. Due process isn't just any legal proceeding. It means a proceeding sanctioned by the settled maxims of Lowell, which demand a 12-person law-judging unanimous jury. A plea bargain does none of these things. It relies on a structural substitution built on coercion. The sources conclude that because a plea bargain is not a trial by peers, and because it's based on duress, it's a structural substitute for lawful government, and is therefore void under that immutable hierarchy of law.
And the really terrifying statistic that you often see cited is that because of this coercive environment, a significant percentage of people who plead guilty are, in fact, innocent.
Yes, studies suggest that somewhere between 15 and 30% of guilty pleas are entered by factually innocent defendants who simply cannot risk the exponentially harsher trial penalty. That outcome, condemning the innocent as a matter of administrative efficiency, is just fundamentally incompatible with justice, with reason, with any definition of the rule of law.
The system is undeniably captured, filtered, and coerced. But the source material doesn't end in despair. It outlines a path to restoration, which starts not by appealing to the courts that engineered the capture, but with the people themselves.
The key is knowledge. The entire destruction of the jury relied on systematic ignorance, what the sources call the education failure. Judges want jurors who are ignorant of their power, prosecutors want them obedient, and the legal bar ensures they remain uniformed. And as we saw, courts actively attack those who try to correct this ignorance.
So the single most important remedial act has to be widespread juror education.
Absolutely. Jurors must learn the truth the government works so tirelessly to hide, that they are the judges of both law and fact, that they have the lawful power to reject unjust statutes, that they can follow their conscience even if it contradicts what the judge says, and that they are immune to punishment for their verdict. If a juror believes a law is applied unjustly, or that the law itself is immoral, their vote of not guilty is the final lawful defense. Without this knowledge, jurors are not constitutional sentinels. They're just spectators, rubber-stamping state action.
So what are the practical steps a citizen could take to restore the legitimate jury?
Well, first, every citizen has to understand and exercise their right to challenge an illegitimate jury composition. If a defendant is facing a jury selected from one of these proprietary digital wheel systems, filtered address databases, any algorithmic system whose parameters are secret, The defendant should challenge the entire pool.
They have to demand to see under the hood.
They have to demand the right to scrutinize the selection software and the algorithmic filtering mechanisms. If the government refuses to release the source code for inspection, the source argues the entire process is illegitimate by definition.
And second, citizens have to strategically refuse the plea bargain and demand a constitutional trial.
This is the mechanism that forces constitutional compliance. The system has been optimized to handle a 1% or 2% trial rate. It does not have the judges, the courtrooms, the public defenders, or the jail capacity to handle a constitutional trial rate of, say, 15 or 20%.
Right.
If even 5 or 10% more citizens exercise their Sixth Amendment right and demanded a trial by a lawful 12-person unanimous law-judging jury, the administrative plea apparatus would just immediately collapse.
That's a compelling thought. A population-wide refusal to plea would dismantle the system's core mechanism of social control.
It forces the government to choose between two options. Either conduct 100% lawful constitutional trials, which they can't afford to do, or begin to exercise radical restraint and only prosecute cases where they have overwhelming evidence of a serious crime. It restores the principle of liberty through non-cooperation with the coercive mechanism.
Finally, what's the ultimate legal defense against this captured system? If you, the listener, were convicted years ago by a 6-person non-law judging jury, what recourse does the source material suggest?
The ultimate defense rests on the principle established in Norton v. Shelby County back in 1886. An unconstitutional act isn't just flawed, it's void. And the court said it as though it had never been passed.
As though it had never been passed.
Because void judgments cannot become valid just by the passage of time, any conviction obtained without a lawful 12-person unanimous law-judging jury is subject to collateral attack.
So this isn't about appealing a mistake. It's about declaring the entire foundation of the judgment a complete nullity.
Correct. The sources argue that the modern system's deviations, the reduced size, the non-unanimity, the gag orders, these are not just issues to be appealed. They are structural nullities. The remedy is to use procedures like habeas corpus or writs of coram nobis to challenge the fundamental authority of the original court. If the court lacked the lawful constitutional mechanism, the true jury, to render a verdict, the judgment is void.
So what does this all mean? The Pettit jury, the central bulwark of individual liberty, it hasn't been lost. It has been unlawfully suppressed, substituted, and suborned. Every modern deviation, the 6-person panels, the judicial gag orders, the opaque algorithms, the systematic plea bargain apparatus, is illegal, unconstitutional, and void ab initio under this unamendable hierarchy of law.
The synthesis is clear. The jury is not a subservient component of the judiciary. It's the people's original tribunal, older than the republic, and superior in authority to the judge on matters of law. When the jury is systematically filtered, muzzled, and bypassed by the plea system, due process disappears, and the rule of law just collapses into an administrative state. The government has spent a century engineering a machine that's designed for obedience and certain conviction.
But the sources conclude with a powerful final thought for us to mull over. A thought that's rooted in the power of that solitary conscience.
The government can arrest educators, it can manipulate statutes, and it can control the proprietary software that selects the pools. But it cannot prevent one juror in one courtroom from voting not guilty based on their conscience and their own interpretation of the law. That solitary vote, derived from the power to judge both law and fact, is the single unbreakable fulcrum of liberty that the state cannot override. The Pettit jury has been buried beneath centuries of lies and legal fiction, but the people can unearth it and reclaim its full common law power at any moment. The ransom for the kidnapped jury is our systematic ignorance and compliance. We pay it no longer.